leagues, and all this is done by the craft and skill of the sage enchanters who take care of those valiant knights. So that, friend Sancho, I find no difficulty in believing that thou mayest have gone from this place too, El Toboso, and returned in such a short time, since, as I have said, some friendly sage must have carried thee through the air without thee perceiving it."
"That must have been it," said Sancho, "for indeed Rocinante went like a gypsy's ass with quicksilver in his ears."
"Quicksilver?" said Don Quixote. "Ay, and what is more, a legion of devils, folk that can travel and make others travel without being weary, exactly as the whim seizes them. But putting this aside, what thinkest thou I ought to do about my lady's command to go and see her? For though I feel that I am bound to obey her mandate, I feel too that I am debarred by the boon I have accorded to the princess that accompanies us, and the law of chivalry compels me to have regard for my word in preference to my inclination. On the one hand, the desire to see my lady pursues and harasses me. On the other, my solemn promise and the glory I shall win in this enterprise urge and call me. But what I think I shall do is to travel with all speed and reach quickly the place where this giant is, and on my arrival I shall cut off his head and establish the princess peacefully in her realm, and forthwith I shall return to behold the light that lightens my senses, to whom I shall make such excuses that she will be led to approve of my delay, for she will see that it entirely tends to increase her glory and fame. For all that I have won, am winning, or shall win by arms in this life, comes to me of the favour she extends to me, and because I am hers."
"Ah, what a sad state your worship's brains are in!" said Sancho. "Tell me, senor, do you mean to travel all that way for nothing, and to let slip and lose so rich and great a match as this, where they give as a portion a kingdom that in sober truth I have heard say is more than 20,000 leagues round about, and abounds with all things necessary to support human life, and is bigger than Portugal and Castile put together? Peace, for the love of God, blush for what you have said, and take my advice and forgive me, and marry at once in the first village where there is a curate. If not, here is our own who will do the business beautifully. Remember, I am old enough to give advice, and this I am giving comes pat to the purpose. For a sparrow in the hand is better than a vulture on the wing, and he who has the good to his hand and chooses the bad, that the good he complains of may not come to him."
"Look here, Sancho," said Don Quixote. "If thou art advising me to marry in order that immediately on slaying the giant I may become king, and be able to confer favours on thee, and give thee what I have promised, let me tell thee I shall be able very easily to satisfy thy desires without marrying. For before going into battle, I will make it a stipulation that if I come out of it victorious, even if I do not marry, they shall give me a portion of the kingdom, that I may bestow it upon whomsoever I choose, and when they give it to me, upon whom wouldst thou have me bestow it, but upon thee?"
"That is plain speaking," said Sancho, "but let your worship take care to choose it on the sea coast, so that if I don't like the life, I may be able to ship off my black vassals and deal with them as I have said. Don't mind going to see my lady Dulcinea now, but go and kill this giant and let us finish off this business. For by God, it strikes me it will be one of great honour and great profit."
"I hold thou art in the right of it, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "and I will take thy advice as to accompanying the princess before going to see Dulcinea. But I counsel thee not to say anything to anyone or to those who are with us about what we have considered and discussed. For as Dulcinea is so decorous that she does not wish her thoughts to be known, it is not right that I or anyone for me should disclose them."
"Well, then, if that be so," said Sancho, "how is it that your worship makes all those you overcome by your arm go to present themselves before my lady Dulcinea, this being the same thing as signing your name to it that you love her and are her lover? And as those who go must perforce kneel before her and say they come from your worship to submit themselves to her, how can the thoughts of both of you be hid?"
"Oh, how silly and simple thou art," said Don Quixote. "Seest thou not, Sancho, that this tends to her greater exaltation? For thou must know that, according to our ways of thinking in chivalry, It is a high honour to a lady to have many knights-errant in her service, whose thoughts never go beyond serving her for her own sake, and who look for no other reward for their great and true devotion than that she should be willing to accept them as her knights.
It is with that kind of love, said Sancho. I have heard preachers say we ought to love our Lord, for himself alone, without being moved by the hope of glory or the fear of punishment. Though, for my part, I would rather love and serve him for what he could do.
That devil take thee for a clown, said Don Quixote, and what shrewd things thou sayest at times. One would think thou hast studied. In faith, then, I cannot even read.
Master Nicholas here called out to them to wait a while, as they wanted to halt and drink at a little spring there was there. Don Quixote drew up, not a little to the satisfaction of Sancho, for he was by this time weary of telling so many lies, and in dread of his master catching him tripping, for though he knew that Dulcinea was a peasant girl of El Toboso, he had never seen her in all his life. Cardenio had now put on the clothes which Dorothea was wearing when they found her, and though they were not very good, they were far better than those he put off. They dismounted together by the side of the spring, and with what the curate had provided himself with at the inn they appeased, though not very well, the keen appetite they had all of them brought with them. While they were so employed, there happened to come by a youth passing on his way, who, stopping to examine the party at the spring, the next moment ran to Don Quixote, and clasping him round the legs, began to weep freely, saying,
"Oh, senor, do you not know me? Look at me well, I am that lad Andres that your worship released from the oak tree where I was tied."
Don Quixote recognized him, and taking his hand he turned to those present and said,
"That your worships may see how important it is to have knights errant to redress the wrongs and injuries done by tyrannical and wicked men in this world. I may tell you that some days ago, passing through a wood, I heard cries and piteous complaints as of a person in pain and distress. I immediately hastened, impelled by my bounden duty, to the quarter whence the plaintive accents seemed to me to proceed, and I found tied to an oak this lad who now stands before you, which in my heart I rejoice at, for his testimony will not permit me to depart from the truth in any particular. He was, I say, tied to an oak, naked from the waist up, and a clown, whom I afterwards found to be his master, was scarifying him by lashes with the reins of his mare. As soon as I saw him, I asked the reason of so cruel a flagellation. The boor replied that he was flogging him because he was his servant, and because of carelessness that proceeded rather from dishonesty than stupidity. On which this boy said, 'Senor, he flogs me only because I ask for my wages.' The master made I know not what speeches and explanations, which, though I listened to them, I did not accept. In short, I compelled the clown to unbind him, and to swear he would take him with him, and pay him real by real, and perfumed into the bargain. Is not all this true, Andres, my son? Didst thou not mark with what authority I commanded him, and with what humility he promised to do all I enjoined, specified, and required of him? Answer without hesitation. Tell these gentlemen what took place, that they may see that it is as great an advantage as I say to have knights errant abroad."
"All that your worship has said is quite true," answered the lad, "but the end of the business turned out just the opposite of what your worship supposes."
"How? The opposite?" said Don Quixote. "Did not the clown pay thee, then?"
"Not only did he not pay me," replied the lad, "but as soon as your worship had passed out of the wood and we were alone, he tied me up again to the same oak and gave me a fresh flogging that left me like a flayed St. Bartholomew. And every stroke he gave me he followed up with some jest or jibe about having made a fool of your worship, and but for the pain I was suffering I should have laughed at the things he said. In short, he left me in such a condition that I have been until now in a hospital getting cured of the injuries which that rascally clown inflicted on me then, for all which your worship is to blame. For if you had gone your own way and not come where there was no call for you, nor meddled in other people's affairs, my master would have been content with giving me one or two dozen lashes, and would have then loosed me and paid me what he owed me. But when your worship abused him so out of measure, and gave him so many hard words, his anger was kindled, and as he could not revenge himself on you, as soon as he saw you had left him, the storm burst upon me in such a way that I feel as if I should never be a man again."
"The mischief," said Don Quixote, "lay in my going away, for I should not have gone until I had seen thee paid, because I ought to have known well by long experience that there is no clown who will keep his word if he finds it will not suit him to keep it. But thou rememberest, Andres,
that I swore if he did not pay thee, I would go and seek him and find him, though he were to hide himself in the whale's belly.
That's true, said Andres, but it was of no use.
Thou shalt see now whether it is of use or not, said Don Quixote. And so saying, he got up hastily, and bade Sancho bridle Rocinante, who was browsing while they were eating. Dorothea asked him what he meant to do. He replied that he meant to go in search of this clown and chastise him for such iniquitous conduct, and see Andres paid to the last maravedi, despite and in the teeth of all the clowns in the world. To which she replied that he must remember that in accordance with his promise he could not engage in any enterprise until he had concluded hers, and that as he knew this better than anyone, he should restrain his ardour until his return from her kingdom.
"That is true," said Don Quixote.
"And Andres must have patience until my return, as you say, Señora. But I once more swear and promise not to stop until I have seen him avenged and paid."
"I have no faith in those oaths," said Andres. "I would rather have now something to help me get to Seville than all the revenges in the world. If you have here anything to eat that I can take with me, give it me, and God be with your worship and all knights errant, and may their errands turn out as well for themselves as they have for me."
Sancho took out from his store a piece of bread and another of cheese, and giving them to the lad, he said,
"Here, take this, brother Andres, for we have all of us a share in your misfortune."
"Why, what share have you got?"
"This share of bread and cheese I'm giving you," answered Sancho.
"And God knows whether I shall feel the want of it myself or not, for I would have you know, friend, that we squires to knights errant have to bear a great deal of hunger and hard fortune, and even other things more easily felt than told."
Andres seized his bread and cheese, and seeing that nobody gave him anything more, bent his head and took hold of the road, as the saying is. However, before leaving, he said,
"For the love of God, Sir Knight Errant, if you ever meet me again, though you may see them cutting me to pieces, give me no aid or succour, but leave me to my misfortune, which will not be so great but that a greater will come to me by being helped by your worship, on whom all the knights errant that have ever been born, God send his curse."
Don Quixote was getting up to chastise him, but he took to his heels at such a pace that no one attempted to follow him. And mightily chapfallen was Don Quixote at Andres's story, and the others had to take great care to restrain their laughter, so as not to put him entirely out of countenance. Chapter 32, which treats of what befell Don Quixote's party at the inn. Their dainty repast being finished, they saddled at once, and without any adventure worth mentioning they reached next day the inn, the object of Sancho Panza's fear and dread. But though he would have rather not entered it, there was no help for it. The landlady, the landlord, their daughter, and Maritornes, when they saw Don Quixote and Sancho coming, went out to welcome them with signs of hearty satisfaction, which Don Quixote received with dignity and gravity, and bade them make up a better bed for him than the last time, to which the landlady replied that if he paid better than he did the last time, she would give him one fit for a prince. Don Quixote said he would, so they made up a tolerable one for him in the same garret as before, and he lay down at once, being sorely shaken and in want of sleep. No sooner was the door shut upon him than the landlady made at the barber, and seizing him by the beard, said,
"By my faith, you are not going to make a beard of my tail any longer. You must give me back the tail, for it is a shame the way that thing of my husband's goes tossing about on the floor. I mean the comb that I used to stick in my good tail."
But for all she tugged at it, the barber would not give it up, until the curate told him to let her have it, as there was now no further occasion for that stratagem, because he might declare himself and appear in his own character, and tell Don Quixote that he had fled to this inn when those thieves, the galley-slaves, robbed him. And should he ask for the princess's squire, they could tell him that she had sent him on before her to give notice to the people of her kingdom that she was coming, and bringing with her the deliverer of them all. On this, the barber cheerfully restored the tale to the landlady, and at the same time they returned all the accessories they had borrowed to effect Don Quixote's deliverance. All the people of the inn were struck with astonishment at the beauty of Dorothea, and even at the comely figure of the shepherd Cardenio. The curate made them get ready such fare as there was in the inn, and the landlord, in hope of better payment, served them up a tolerably good dinner. All this time Don Quixote was asleep, and they thought it best not to waken him, as sleeping would now do him more good than eating. While at dinner, the company consisting of the landlord, his wife, their daughter Maritornes, and all the travellers, They discussed the strange craze of Don Quixote and the manner in which he had been found, and the landlady told them what had taken place between him and the carrier, and then, looking round to see if Sancho was there, when she saw he was not, she gave them a whole story of his blanketing, which they received with no little amusement. But the curate, observing that it was the books of chivalry which Don Quixote had read that had turned his brain, the landlord said,
"I cannot understand how that can be, for in truth, to my mind, there is no better reading in the world, and I have here two or three of them, with other writings that are the very life, not only of myself, but of plenty more. For when it is harvest time, the reapers flock here on holidays, and there is always one among them who can read, and who takes up one of these books, and we gather round him, 30 or more of us, and stay listening to him with a delight that makes our grey hairs grow young again. At least, I can say for myself that when I hear of what furious and terrible blows the knights deliver, I am seized with the longing to do the same, and I would like to be hearing about them night and day."
"And I just as much," said the landlady, "because I never have a quiet moment in my house except when you are listening to someone reading, for then you are so taken up that for the time being you forget to scold."
"That is true," said Maritornes, "and faith, I relish hearing these things greatly too, for they are very pretty, especially when they describe some lady or another in the arms of her knight under the orange trees, and the duenna who is keeping watch for them half dead with envy and fright. All this, I say, is as good as honey."
"And you, what do you think, young lady?" said the curate, turning to the landlord's daughter.
"I don't know indeed, senor," said she. "I listen too, and to tell the truth, though I do not understand it, I like hearing it. But it is not the blows that my father likes that I like, but the laments the knights utter when they are separated from their ladies. And indeed they sometimes make me weep with the pity I feel for them."
"Then you would console them if it was for you they wept, young lady?" said Dorothea.
"I don't know what I should do," said the girl. "I only know that there are some of those ladies so cruel that they call their knights tigers and lions and a thousand other foul names. And, Jesus, I don't know what sort of folk they can be, so unfeeling and heartless, that rather than bestow a glance upon a worthy man, they leave him to die or go mad. I don't know what is the good of such prudery. If it is for honour's sake, why not marry them? That's all they want."
"Hush, child," said the landlady. "It seems to me thou knowest a great deal about these things, and it is not fit for girls to know or talk so much."
"As the gentleman asked me, I could not help answering him," said the girl.
"Well, then," said the curate, "bring me these books, Señor Landlord, for I should like to see them."
"With all my heart," said he.
And going into his own room, he brought out an old valise secured with a little chain, on opening which the curate found in it three large books and some manuscripts written in a very good hand. The first that he opened he found to be Don Cirongilio of Thrace, and the second Don Felix Marte of Hircania, and the other the History of the Great Captain Gonzalo Hernandez de Cordova, with the Life of Diego Garcia de Paredes. When the curate read the two first titles, he looked over at the barber and said, "We want my friend's housekeeper and niece here now."
"Nay," said the barber, "I can do just as well to carry them to the yard or to the hearth, and there is a very good fire there." "What? Your worship would burn my books?" said the landlord.
"Only these two," said the curate, "Don Cirongilio and Felix Marte."
"Are my books, then, heretics or phlegmatics that you want to burn them?" said the landlord.
"Schismatics, you mean, friend," said the barber, "not phlegmatics."
"That's the one," said the landlord. "But if you want to burn any, let it be that about the great captain and that Diego Garcia, for I would rather have a child of mine burnt than either of the others."
"Brother," said the curate, "those two books are made up of lies and are full of folly and nonsense. But this of the great captain is a true history, and contains the deeds of Gonzalo Hernandez of Cordova, who, by his many and great achievements, earned the title all over the world of the Great Captain, a famous and illustrious name, and deserved by him alone. And this Diego Garcia de Paredes was a distinguished knight of the city of Trujillo in Extremadura, a most gallant soldier, and of such bodily strength that with one finger he stopped a mill-wheel in full motion. And, posted with a two-handed sword at the foot of a bridge, he kept the whole of an immense army from passing over it, and achieved such other exploits that if, instead of his relating them himself with the modesty of a knight and of one writing his own history, some free and unbiased writer had recorded them, they would have thrown into the shade all the deeds of the Hectors, Achilleses, and Rolands.
"Tell that to my father," said the landlord. "There's a thing to be astonished at, stopping a mill-wheel. By God, your worship should read what I have read of Felix Marty of Hyrcania, how with one single backstroke he cleft 5 giants asunder through the middle, as if they had been made of bean-pods like the little friars the children make. And another time he attacked a very great and powerful army, in which there were more than 1,600,000 soldiers, all armed from head to foot, and he routed them all as if they had been flocks of sheep. And then, what do you say to the good Suron Helio of Thrace, that was so stout and bold, as may be seen in the book where it is related, that as he was sailing along a river, there came up out of the midst of the water against him a fiery serpent, and he, as soon as he saw it, flung himself upon it, and got astride of its scaly shoulders, and squeezed its throat with both hands with such force that the serpent, finding he was throttling it, had nothing for it but to let itself sink to the bottom of the river, carrying with it the knight who would not let go his hold. And when they got down there, he found himself among palaces and gardens so pretty that it was a wonder to see. And then the serpent changed itself into an old ancient man who told him such things as were never heard. Hold your peace, senor, for if you were to hear this, you would go mad with delight. A couple of figs for your great captain and your Diego Garcia.
Hearing this, Dorothea said in a whisper to Cardenio, "Our landlord is almost fit to play a second part to Don Quixote."
"I think so," said Cardenio, "for, as he shows, he accepts it as a certainty that everything those books relate took place exactly as it is written down, and the barefooted friars themselves would not persuade him to the contrary."
"But consider, brother," said the curate once more, "there never was any Felix Marte of Hyrcania in the world, nor any Suron Helio of Thrace, or any of the other knights of the same sort that the books of chivalry talk of. The whole thing is the fabrication and invention of idle wits, devised by them for the purpose you describe, of beguiling the time, as your reapers do when they read. For I swear to you, in all seriousness, there never were any such knights in the world, and no such exploits or nonsense ever happened anywhere."
"Try that bone on another dog," said the landlord, "as if I did not know how many make 5 and where my shoe pinches me. Don't think to feed me with pap, for by God I am no fool. It is a good joke for your worship to try and persuade me that everything these good books say is nonsense and lies, and they printed by the license of the lords of the royal council, as if they were people who would allow such a lot of lies to be printed altogether, and so many battles and enchantments that they take away one's senses."
"I have told you, friend," said the curate, "that this is done to divert our idle thoughts, and as in well-ordered states games of chess, 5s and billiards are allowed for the diversion of those who do not care, or are not obliged, or are unable to work, so books of this kind are allowed to be printed, on the supposition that, what indeed is the truth, there can be nobody so ignorant as to take any of them for true stories. And if it were permitted me now, and the present company desired it, I could say something about the qualities books of chivalry should possess to be good ones, that would be to the advantage and even to the taste of some. But I hope the time will come when I can communicate my ideas to someone who may be able to mend matters. And in the meantime, Senor Landlord, believe what I have said, and take your books, and make up your mind about their truth or falsehood, and much good may they do you. And God grant you may not fall lame of the same foot as your guest Don Quixote halts on."
"No fear of that," returned the landlord. "I shall not be so mad as to make a knight-errant of myself, for I see well enough that things are not now as they used to be in those days, when they say those famous knights roamed about the world."
Sancho had made his appearance in the middle of this conversation, and he was very much troubled and cast down by what he heard said about knights-errant being now no longer in vogue, and all books of chivalry being folly and lies. And he resolved in his heart to wait and see what came of this journey of his master's, and if it did not turn out as happily as his master expected, he determined to leave him, and go back to his wife and children and his ordinary labour. The landlord was carrying away the valise and the books, but the curate said to him,
"Wait! I want to see what those papers are that are written in such a good hand."
The landlord, taking them out, handed them to him to read, and he perceived they were a work of about 8 sheets of manuscript, with, in large letters at the beginning, the title, "Novel of the Ill-Advised Curiosity." The curate read 3 or 4 lines to himself, and said,
"I must say, the title of this novel does not seem to me a bad one, and I feel an inclination to read it all."
To which the landlord replied,
"Then your reverence will do well to read it, for I can tell you that some guests who have read it here have been much pleased with it, and have begged it of me very earnestly. But I would not give it, meaning to return it to the person who forgot the valise, books and papers here, for maybe he will return here some time or other. And though I know I shall miss the books, faith, I mean to return them, for though I am an innkeeper, still I am a Christian."
"You are very right, friend," said the curate. "But for all that, if the novel pleases me, you must let me copy it."
"With all my heart," replied the host.
While they were talking, Cardenio had taken up the novel and begun to read it, and forming the same opinion of it as the curate, he begged him to read it so that they might all hear it.
"I would read it," said the curate, "if the time would not be better spent in sleeping."
"It will be rest enough for me," said Dorothea, "to while away the time by listening to some tale, for my spirits are not yet tranquil enough to let me sleep when it would be seasonable."
"Well, then, in that case," said the curate, "I will read it, if it were only out of curiosity. Perhaps it may contain something pleasant."
Master Nicholas added his entreaties to the same effect, and Sancho too, seeing which, and considering that he would give pleasure to all, and receive it himself, the curate said,
"Well then, attend to me, everyone, for the novel begins thus."
Chapter 33, in which is related the novel of the Ill-Advised Curiosity. In Florence, a rich and famous city of Italy in the province called Tuscany, there lived two gentlemen of wealth and quality, Anselmo and Lotario, such great friends that by way of distinction they were called by all that knew them the Two Friends. They were unmarried, young, of the same age and of the same tastes, which was enough to account for the reciprocal friendship between them. Anselmo, it is true, was somewhat more inclined to seek pleasure in love than Lotario, for whom the pleasures of the chase had more attraction. But on occasion Anselmo would forego his own tastes to yield to those of Lotario, and Lotario would surrender his to fall in with those of Anselmo, and in this way their inclinations kept pace one with the other, with a concord so perfect that the best regulated clock could not surpass it. Anselmo was deep in love with a high-born and beautiful maiden of the same city, the daughter of parents so estimable, and so estimable herself, that he resolved, with the approval of his friend Lotario, without whom he did nothing, to ask her of them in marriage, and did so, Lotario being the bearer of the demand, and conducting the negotiation so much to the satisfaction of his friend, that in a short time he was in possession of the object of his desires, and Camilla, so happy in having won Anselmo for her husband, that she gave thanks unceasingly to heaven and to Lotario, by whose means such good fortune had fallen to her. The first few days, those of a wedding being usually days of merrymaking, Lotario frequented his friend Anselmo's house as he had been wont, striving to do honour to him and to the occasion, and to gratify him in every way he could. But when the wedding days were over and the succession of visits and congratulations had slackened, he began purposely to leave off going to the house of Anselmo, for it seemed to him, as it naturally would to all men of sense, that friends' houses ought not to be visited after marriage with the same frequency as in their master's bachelor days, because, though true and genuine friendship cannot and should not be in any way suspicious, still a married man's honour is a thing of such delicacy that it is held liable to injury from brothers, much more from friends. Anselmo remarked the cessation of Lotario's visits, and complained of it to him, saying that if he had known that marriage was to keep him from enjoying his society as he used, he would never have married, and that if, by the thorough harmony that subsisted between them while he was a bachelor, they had earned such a sweet name as that of the Two Friends, he should not allow a title so rare and so delightful to be lost through a needless anxiety to act circumspectly. And so he entreated him, if such a phrase was allowable between them, to be once more master of his house, and to come in and go out as formerly, assuring him that his wife Camilla had no other desire or inclination than that which he would wish her to have, and that knowing how sincerely they loved one another, she was grieved to see such coldness in him. To all this and much more that Anselmo said to Lotario, to persuade him to come to his house as he had been in the habit of doing, Lotario replied with so much prudence, sense, and judgment, that Anselmo was satisfied of his friend's good intentions, and it was agreed that on 2 days in the week and on holidays, Lotario should come to dine with him. But though this arrangement was made between them, Lotario resolved to observe it no further than he considered to be in accordance with the honour of his friend, whose good name was more to him than his own. He said, and justly, that a married man upon whom heaven had bestowed a beautiful wife should consider as carefully what friends he brought to his house as what female friends his wife associated with. For what cannot be done or arranged in the marketplace, in church, at public festivals, or at stations, opportunities that husbands cannot always deny their wives, may be easily managed in the house of the female friend or relative in whom most confidence is reposed. Lotario said, too, that every married man should have some friend who would point out to him any negligence he might be guilty of in his conduct, for it will sometimes happen that, owing to the deep affection the husband bears his wife, either he does not caution her, or, not to vex her, refrains from telling her to do or not to do certain things, doing or avoiding which may be a matter of honour or reproach to him, and errors of this kind he could easily correct if warned by a friend. But where is such a friend to be found as Lotario would have, so judicious, so loyal, and so true? Of a truth I know not. Lotario alone was such a one, for with the utmost care and vigilance he watched over the honour of his friend and strove to diminish, cut down, and reduce the number of days for going to his house according to their agreement, lest the visits of a young man, wealthy, high-born, and with the attractions he was conscious of possessing, at the house of a woman so beautiful as Camilla, should be regarded with suspicion by the inquisitive and malicious eyes of the idle public. For though his integrity and reputation might bridle slanderous tongues, still he was unwilling to hazard either his own good name or that of his friend, and for this reason most of the days agreed upon he devoted to some other business which he pretended was unavoidable, so that a great portion of the day was taken up with complaints on one side and excuses on the other. It happened, however, that on one occasion when the two were strolling together outside the city, Anselmo addressed the following words to Lotario. "Thou mayest suppose, Lotario, my friend, that I am unable to give sufficient thanks for the favours God has rendered me in making me the son of such parents as mine were, and bestowing upon me with no niggard hand what are called the gifts of nature, as well as those of fortune, and above all what he has done in giving me thee for a friend and Camilla for a wife, two treasures that I value, if not as highly as I ought, at least as highly as I am able. And yet, with all these good things, which are commonly all that men need to enable them to live happily, I am the most discontented and dissatisfied man in the whole world. For I know not how long since I have been harassed and oppressed by a desire so strange and so unusual, that I wonder at myself, and blame and chide myself when I am alone, and strive to stifle it and hide it from my own thoughts, and with no better success than if I were endeavouring deliberately to publish it to all the world. And as, in short, it must come out, I would confide it to thy safe keeping, feeling sure that by this means, and by thy readiness as a true friend to afford me relief, I shall soon find myself freed from the distress it causes me, and that thy care will give me happiness in the same degree as my own folly has caused me misery." The words of Anselmo struck Lothario with astonishment, unable as he was to conjecture the purport of such a lengthy preamble. And though he strove to imagine what desire it could be that so troubled his friend, his conjectures were all far from the truth, and to relieve the anxiety which this perplexity was causing him, he told him he was doing a flagrant injustice to their great friendship in seeking circuitous methods of confiding to him his most hidden thoughts, for he well knew he might reckon upon his counsel in diverting them, or his help in carrying them into effect. "That is the truth," replied Anselmo, "and relying upon that I will tell thee, friend Lotario, that the desire which harasses me is that of knowing whether my wife Camilla is as good and perfect as I think her to be, and I cannot satisfy myself of the truth on this point except by testing her in such a way that the trial may prove the purity of her virtue, as the fire proves that of gold. Because I am persuaded, my friend, that a woman is virtuous only in proportion as she is or is not tempted, and that she alone is strong who does not yield to the promises, gifts, tears, and importunities of earnest lovers. For what thanks does a woman deserve for being good if no one urges her to be bad? And what wonder is it that she is reserved and circumspect, to whom no opportunity is given of going wrong, and who knows she has a husband that will take her life the first time he detects her in an impropriety? I do not therefore hold her who is virtuous through fear or want of opportunity in the same estimation as her who comes out of temptation and trial with a crown of victory. And so, for these reasons and many others that I could give thee to justify and support the opinion I hold, I am desirous that my wife Camilla should pass this crisis, and be refined and tested by the fire of finding herself wooed, and by one worthy to set his affections upon her. And if she comes out, as I know she will, victorious from this struggle, I shall look upon my good fortune as unequalled. I shall be able to say that the cup of my desire is full, and that the virtuous woman of whom the sage says, "Who shall find her?" has fallen to my lot. And if the result be to the contrary of what I expect, in the satisfaction of knowing that I have been right in my opinion, I shall bear without complaint the pain which my so dearly bought experience will naturally cause me. And as nothing of all thou wilt urge in opposition to my wish will avail to keep me from carrying it into effect, it is my desire, friend Lotario, that thou shouldst consent to become the instrument for effecting this purpose that I am bent upon, for I will afford thee opportunities to that end, and nothing shall be wanting that I may think necessary for the pursuit of a virtuous, honourable, modest, and high-minded woman. And among other reasons, I am induced to entrust this arduous task to thee, by the consideration that, if Camilla be conquered by thee, the conquest will not be, pushed to extremes, but only far enough to account that accomplished which, from a sense of honour, will be left undone. Thus I shall not be wronged in anything more than intention, and my wrong will remain buried in the integrity of thy silence, which, I know well, will be as lasting as that of death in what concerns me. If, therefore, thou wouldst have me enjoy what can be called life, thou wilt at once engage in this love struggle, not lukewarmly nor slothfully, but with the energy and zeal that my desire demands, and with the loyalty our friendship assures me of. Such were the words Anselmo addressed to Lotario, who listened to them with such attention that, except to say what has been already mentioned, he did not open his lips until the other had finished. Then, perceiving that he had no more to say, after regarding him for a while as one would regard something never before seen that excited wonder and amazement, he said to him, "I cannot persuade myself, Anselmo, my friend, that what thou hast said to me is not in jest. If I thought that thou wert speaking seriously, I would not have allowed thee to go so far, so as to put a stop to thy long harangue by not listening to thee. I verily suspect that either thou dost not know me, or I do not know thee. But no, I know well thou art Anselmo, and thou knowest that I am Lotario. The misfortune is, it seems to me, that thou art not the Anselmo thou wert, and must have thought that I am not the Lotario I should be, for the things that thou hast said to me are not those of that Anselmo who was my friend, nor are those that thou demandest of me what should be asked of the Lotario thou knowest. True friends will prove their friends, and make use of them, as a poet has said, usque ad aras, up to the altar, whereby he meant that they will not make use of their friendship in things that are contrary to God's will. If this, then, was a heathen's feeling about friendship, how much more should it be a Christian's? Who knows that the divine must not be forfeited for the sake of any human friendship? And if a friend should go so far as to put aside his duty to heaven to fulfil his duty to his friend, it should not be in matters that are trifling or of little moment, but in such as affect the friend's life and honour. Now tell me, Anselmo, in which of these two art thou imperilled that I should hazard myself to gratify thee, and do a thing so detestable as that thou seekest of me? Neither, forsooth. On the contrary, thou dost ask of me, so far as I understand, to strive and labour to rob thee of honour and life, and to rob myself of them at the same time. For if I take away thy honour, it is plain I take away thy life, as a man without honour is worse than dead. and being the instrument, as thou wilt have it so, of so much wrong to thee, shall not I, too, be left without honour, and consequently without life? Listen to me, Anselmo, my friend, and be not impatient to answer me, until I have said what occurs to me touching the object of thy desire, for there will be time enough left for thee to reply, and for me to hear.
Be it so, said Anselmo, say what thou wilt.
Lotario then went on to say, It seems to me, Anselmo, that thine is just now the temper of mind which is always that of the Moors, who can never be brought to see the error of their creed by quotations from the Holy Scriptures, or by reasons which depend upon the examination of the understanding, or are founded upon the articles of faith, but must have examples that are palpable, easy, intelligible, capable of proof, not admitting of doubt, with mathematical demonstrations that cannot be denied, like, if equals be taken from equals, the remainders are equal. And if they do not understand this in words, and indeed they do not, it has to be shown to them with the hands, and put before their eyes, and even with all this, no one succeeds in convincing them of the truth of our holy religion. This same mode of proceeding I shall have to adopt with thee, for the desire which has sprung up in thee is so absurd and remote from everything that has a semblance of reason, that I feel it would be a waste of time to employ it in reasoning with thy simplicity, for at present I will call it by no other name, and I am even tempted to leave thee in thy folly as a punishment for thy pernicious desire. But the friendship I bear thee, which will not allow me to desert thee in such manifest danger of destruction, keeps me from dealing so harshly by thee. And that thou mayest clearly see this, say, Anselmo, hast thou not told me that I must force my suit upon a modest woman, decoy one that is virtuous, make overtures to one that is pure-minded, pay court to one that is prudent? Yes, thou hast told me so. Then, if thou knowest that thou hast a wife, modest, virtuous, pure-minded, and prudent, what is it that thou seekest? And if thou believest that she will come forth victorious from all my attacks, as doubtless she would, what higher titles than those she possesses now dost thou think thou canst upon her then, or in what will she be better then than she is now? Either thou dost not hold her to be what thou sayest, or thou knowest not what thou dost demand. If thou dost not hold her to be what thou sayest, why dost thou seek to prove her, instead of treating her as guilty in the way that may seem best to thee? But if she be as virtuous as thou believest, it is an uncalled-for proceeding to make trial of truth itself, for, after trial, it will be but in the same estimation as before. Thus, then, it is conclusive that to attempt things from which harm rather than advantage may come to us is the part of unreasoning and reckless minds, more especially when they are things which we are not forced or compelled to attempt, and which show from afar that it is plainly madness to attempt them. Difficulties are attempted either for the sake of God, or for the sake of the world, or for both. Those undertaken for God's sake are those which the saints undertake when they attempt to live the lives of angels in human bodies. Those undertaken for the sake of the world are those of the men who traverse such a vast expanse of water, such a variety of climates, so many strange countries, to acquire what are called the blessings of fortune. And those undertaken for the sake of God and the world together are those of brave soldiers, who no sooner do they see in the enemy's wall a breach as wide as a cannonball could make, than, casting aside all fear, without hesitating or heeding the manifest peril that threatens them, borne onwards by the desire of defending their faith, their country, and their king, they fling themselves dauntlessly into the midst of the thousand opposing deaths that await them. Such are the things that men are wont to attempt, and there is honour, glory, gain in attempting them, however full of difficulty and peril they may be. But that which thou sayest it is thy wish to attempt and carry out will not win thee the glory of God, nor the blessings of fortune, nor fame among men. For even if the issue be as thou wouldst have it, thou wilt be no happier, richer, or more honoured than thou art this moment. And if it be otherwise, thou wilt be reduced to misery greater than can be imagined, for then it will avail thee nothing to reflect that no one is aware of the misfortune that has befallen thee. It will suffice to torture and crush thee, that thou knowest it thyself. And in confirmation of the truth of what I say, let me repeat to thee a stanza made by the famous poet Luigi Tanzilio, at the end of the first part of his Tears of St. Peter, which says thus, "The anguish and the shame but greater grew in Peter's heart as morning slowly came. No eye was there to see him, well he knew, yet he himself was to himself a shame. Exposed to all men's gaze, or screened from view, a noble heart will feel the pang the same. A prey to shame the sinning soul will be, though none but heaven and earth its shame can see. Thus, by keeping it secret, thou wilt not escape thy sorrow, but rather thou wilt shed tears unceasingly, if not tears of the eyes, tears of blood from the heart, like those shed by that simple doctor our poet tells us of, that tried the test of the cup, which the wise Rinaldo, better advised, refused to do. For though this may be a poetic fiction, it contains a moral lesson worthy of attention and study and imitation. Moreover, by what I am about to say to thee, thou wilt be led to see the great error thou wouldst commit. Tell me, Anselmo, if heaven or good fortune had made thee master and lawful owner of a diamond of the finest quality, with the excellence and purity of which all the lapidaries that had seen it had been satisfied, saying with one voice and common consent that in purity, quality, and fineness it was all that a stone of the kind could possibly be, thou thyself too being of the same belief, as knowing nothing to the contrary, would it be reasonable in thee to desire to take that diamond and place it between an anvil and a hammer, and by mere force of blows and strength of arm, try if it were as hard and as fine as they said? And if thou didst, and if the stone should resist so silly a test, that would add nothing to its value or reputation. And if it were broken, as it might be, would not all be lost? Undoubtedly it would, leaving its owner to be rated as a fool in the opinion of all. Consider then, Anselmo, my friend, that Camilla is a diamond of the finest quality, as well in thy estimation as in that of others, and that it is contrary to reason to expose her to the risk of being broken. For if she remains intact, she cannot rise to a higher value than she now possesses. And if she give way and be unable to resist, bethink thee how thou wilt be deprived of her, and with what good reason thou wilt complain of thyself for having been the cause of her ruin and thine own. Remember, there is no jewel in the world so precious as a chaste and virtuous woman, and that the whole honour of women consists in reputation. And since thy wife's is of that high excellence that thou knowest, wherefore shouldst thou seek to call that truth in question? Remember, my friend, that woman is an imperfect animal, and that impediments are not to be placed in her way to make her trip and fall, but that they should be removed, and her path left clear of all obstacles, so that without hindrance she may run her course freely to attain the desired perfection, which consists in being virtuous. Naturalists tell us that the ermine is a little animal which has a fur of purest white, and that when the hunters wish to take it, they make use of this artifice. Having ascertained the places which it frequents and passes, they stop the way to them with mud, and then, rousing it, drive it towards the spot, and as soon as the ermine comes to the mud, it halts and allows itself to be taken captive, rather than pass through the mire and spoil and sully its whiteness, which it values more than life and liberty. The virtuous and chaste woman is an ermine, and whiter and purer than snow is the virtue of modesty, and he who wishes her not to lose it, but to keep and preserve it, must adopt a course different from that employed with the ermine. He must not put before her the mire of the gifts and attentions of persevering lovers, because, perhaps, and even without a perhaps, she may not have sufficient virtue and natural strength in herself to pass through and tread underfoot these impediments. They must be removed, and the brightness of virtue and the beauty of a fair fame must be put before her. A virtuous woman, too, is like a mirror of clear, shining crystal, liable to be tarnished and dimmed by every breath that touches it. She must be treated as relics are, adored, not touched. She must be protected and prized as one protects and prizes a fair garden full of roses and flowers, the owner of which allows no one to trespass or pluck a blossom. Enough for others that from afar and through the iron grating they may enjoy its fragrance and its beauty. Finally, let me repeat to thee some verses that come to mind. I heard them in a modern comedy, and it seems to me they bear upon the point we are discussing. A prudent old man was giving advice to another, the father of a young girl, to lock her up, watch over her, and keep her in seclusion. And among other arguments, he used these. Woman is a thing of glass, but her brittleness 'tis best not too curiously to test. Who knows what may come to pass? Breaking is an easy matter, and it's folly to expose what you cannot mend to blows, what you can't make whole to shatter. This then all may hold as true, and the reason's plain to see. For if Danaes there be, there are golden showers too. All that I have said to thee so far, Anselmo, has had reference to what concerns thee. Now it is right that I should say something of what regards myself, and if I be prolix, pardon me, for the labyrinth into which thou hast entered, and from which thou wouldst have me extricate thee, makes it necessary. Thou dost reckon me thy friend, and thou wouldst rob me of honour, a thing wholly inconsistent with friendship. And not only dost thou aim at this, but thou wouldst have me rob thee of it also. That thou wouldst rob me of it is clear, for when Camilla sees that I pay court to her as thou requirest, she will certainly regard me as a man without honour or right feeling, since I attempt and do a thing so much opposed to what I owe to my own position and thy friendship. That thou wouldst have me rob thee of it is beyond a doubt, for Camilla, seeing that I press my suit upon her, will suppose that I have perceived in her something light that has encouraged me to make known to her my base desire. And if she holds herself dishonoured, her dishonour touches thee as belonging to her, and hence arises what so commonly takes place, that the husband of the adulterous woman, though he may not be aware of or have given any cause for his wife's failure in her duty, or, being careless or negligent, have had it in his power to prevent his dishonour, nevertheless is stigmatized by a vile and reproachful name, and in a manner regarded with eyes of contempt instead of pity by all who know of his wife's guilt, though they see that he is unfortunate not by his own fault, but by the lust of a vicious consort. But I will tell thee why, with good reason, dishonour attaches to the husband of the unchaste wife, though he know not that she is so, nor be to blame, nor have done anything or given any provocation to make her so. And be not weary with listening to me, for it will be for thy good. When God created our first parent in the earthly paradise, the Holy Scripture says that he infused sleep into Adam, and while he slept, took a rib from his left side, of which he formed our mother Eve. And when Adam awoke and beheld her, he said, "This is flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone." And God said, "For this shall a man leave his father and his mother, and they shall be two in one flesh." And then was instituted the divine sacrament of marriage, with such ties that death alone can loose them. And such is the force and virtue of this miraculous sacrament, that it makes two different persons one and the same flesh, and even more than this, when the virtuous are married. For though they have two souls, they have but one will. And hence it follows that as the flesh of the wife is one and the same with that of her husband, the stains that may come upon it, or the injuries it incurs, fall upon the husband's flesh, though he, as has been said, may have given no cause for them. For as the pain of the foot or any member of the body is felt by the whole body, because all is one flesh, as the head feels the hurt to the ankle without having caused it, so the husband, being one with her, shares the dishonour of the wife. And as all worldly honour or dishonour comes of flesh and blood, and the erring wife's is of that kind, the husband must needs bear his part of it, and be held dishonoured without knowing it. See then, Anselmo, the peril thou art encountering in seeking to disturb the peace of thy virtuous consort. See for what an empty and ill-advised curiosity thou wouldst rouse up passions that now repose in quiet in the breast of thy chaste wife. Reflect that what thou art staking all to win is little, and what thou wilt lose so much that I leave it undescribed, not having the words to express it. But if all I have said be not enough to turn thee from thy vile purpose, thou must seek some other instrument for thy dishonour and misfortune, for such I will not consent to be, though I lose thy friendship, the greatest loss that I can conceive. Having said this, the wise and virtuous Lotario was silent, and Anselmo, troubled in mind and deep in thought, was unable for a while to utter a word in reply. But at length he said, "I have listened, Lotario, my friend, attentively, as thou hast seen, to what thou hast chosen to say to me, and in thy arguments, examples, and comparisons, I have seen that high intelligence thou dost possess, and the perfection of true friendship thou hast reached. And likewise I see and confess that if I am not guided by thy opinion, but follow my own, I am flying from the good and pursuing the evil. This being so, thou must remember that I am now labouring under that infirmity which women sometimes suffer from, when the craving seizes them to eat clay, plaster, charcoal, and things even worse, disgusting to look at, much more to eat, so that it will be necessary to have recourse to some artifice to cure me. And this can be easily effected if only thou wilt make a beginning, even though it be in a lukewarm and make-believe fashion, to pay court to Camilla, who will not be so yielding that her virtue will give way at the first attack. With this mere attempt I shall rest satisfied, and thou wilt have done what our friendship binds thee to do, not only in giving me life, but in persuading me not to discard my honour. And this thou art bound to do, for one reason alone, that, being as I am resolved to apply this test, it is not for thee to permit me to reveal my weakness to another, and so imperil that honour thou art striving to keep me from losing. And if thine may not stand as high as it ought in the estimation of Camilla while thou art paying court to her, that is of little or no importance, because ere long, on finding in her that constancy which we expect, thou canst tell her the plain truth as regards our stratagem, and so regain thy place in her esteem. And as thou art venturing so little, and by the venture canst afford me so much satisfaction, refuse not to undertake it, even if further difficulties present themselves to thee. For as I have said, if thou wilt only make a beginning, I will acknowledge the issue decided." Lotario, seeing the fixed determination of Anselmo, and not knowing what further examples to offer or arguments to urge in order to dissuade him from it, and perceiving that he threatened to confide his pernicious scheme to someone else, to avoid a greater evil, resolved to gratify him and do what he asked, intending to manage the business so as to satisfy Anselmo without corrupting the mind of Camilla. So in reply he told him not to communicate his purpose to any other, for he would undertake the task himself, and would begin it as soon as he pleased. Anselmo embraced him warmly and affectionately, and thanked him for his offer as if he had bestowed some great favour upon him, and it was agreed between them to set about it the next day, Anselmo affording opportunity and time to Lotario to converse alone with Camilla, and furnishing him with money and jewels to offer and present to her. He suggested, too, that he should treat her to music, and write verses in her praise, and if he was unwilling to take the trouble of composing them, he offered to do it himself. Lotario agreed to all with an intention very different from what Anselmo supposed, and with this understanding they returned to Anselmo's house, where they found Camilla awaiting her husband anxiously and uneasily, for he was later than usual in returning that day. Lotario repaired to his own house, and Anselmo remained in his, as well satisfied as Lotario was troubled in mind, for he could see no satisfactory way out of this ill-advised business. That night, however, he thought of a plan by which he might deceive Anselmo without any injury to Camilla. The next day he went to dine with his friend, and was welcomed by Camilla, who received and treated him with great cordiality, knowing the affection her husband felt for him. When dinner was over and the cloth removed, Anselmo told Lotario to stay there with Camilla while he attended to some pressing business, as he would return in an hour and a half. Camilla begged him not to go, and Lotario offered to accompany him, but nothing could persuade Anselmo, who on the contrary pressed Lotario to remain waiting for him, as he had a matter of great importance to discuss with him. At the same time he bade Camilla not to leave Lotario alone until he came back. In short, he contrived to put so good a face on the reason or the folly of his absence that no one could have suspected it was a pretense. Anselmo took his departure, and Camilla and Lotario were left alone at the table, for the rest of the household had gone to dinner. Lotario saw himself in the lists according to his friend's wish, and facing an enemy that could by her beauty alone vanquish a squadron of armed knights. Judge whether he had good reason to fear, but what he did was to lean his elbow